Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend, Plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did,
so wise you are,
was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello and welcome all you strangers and aliens to the Strangers and Aliens Podcast, and we are doing a special mini-sode, which generally for us tend to be, you know, smaller topics and just two of the three sci-fi guys. And so today it's me, Ben Avery,
and me, Steve McDonald.
And Dr. Jace is not here. He is taking care of his family, which is now a family of three.
Awesome.
Yes, very nice.
Congratulations, Dr. Jace.
Yes, congratulations. And, you know, Steve and I were hoping it'd be a boy. That they would name it, you know, Benjamin Stephen O'Neill.
Or Stephen Benjamin. We're really hoping.
Either way, of course, Benjamin Stephen would be better.
Well, the Stephen Benjamin just has that ring, that roll to it that you look for in a name. Not the stiltedness of a Benjamin Stephen. It just sounds like a robot or something. But, yeah, I see your point.
Yeah, it sounds like a robot if a robot is saying it, but... Yeah, Benjamin.
I just said it.
Benjamin Stephen. Benjamin Stephen O'Neill. That has a ring. Oh, well. It's not a boy, so it doesn't matter.
No, but congratulations. Awesome.
Yes. So, we are putting together this mini-sode because of a movie that came out this weekend that both Steve and I had, I won't say both Steve and I had the pleasure of seeing because I don't want to give away the ending of
podcast. We haven't talked about it yet, so you guys are getting this fresh.
We went and saw, not together, of course, because we are, you know, hundreds of miles away, but we both went and saw John Carter this weekend.
And just as a disclaimer, I'm just going to let you know where I saw it, although if I could tell you the address, it would mean nothing, but I saw it at one of those IMAX 3D giant screen theaters.
And you saw it in 3D? I
saw it in 3D, in one of the biggest screens in America, so
I did not. Okay. I saw it in 3D on one of the smallest screens in America.
And downloaded to an iPhone. And
I'm going to tell you something. I was disappointed that I had to see it in 3D. I did not want to see it in 3D. You know, part of it is the cheapskate in me. I didn't want to have to pay rental, or I don't know if you're buying those glasses or what, because they asked for them back.
You're renting them,
but yeah, you know, the only showings, there was two not 3D showings in the afternoon today.
When I heard it wasn't actually shot in 3D, it was given like the 3D wash, you know.
I was worried about that. Because I heard all the horror stories about Clash of the Titans. That movie in 3D just was not a good thing to behold. I didn't hear many good things about it in 2D either, but
it was a fun action pick. I mean, you really can't go too far.
I'll tell you, the trailer for the sequel, man, that looks crazy.
It does, but you know what? It also looks like, you know, just a fun action flick. I don't think it's
more of the same.
I don't think it's a game changer. You know, there's certain movies where you're like, okay, this is out of the ballpark.
Well, okay, so. Back to John Carter of Mars. I wanted to see it in 2D, saw it in 3D, but the 3D didn't bother me.
No.
At all.
3D, for what it was, the 3D, they did well with.
Yeah. So I think the way we should do this here, Steve, is we talk about the movie.
Okay.
And I've got a couple things that I'd like to kind of discuss. You said you had some questions you wanted to ask me, assuming about, like, what did I think about something that you had an opinion about as well.
Right, yeah.
And then at the end, let's just tell everyone if we recommend it or not. What
okay,
do you think?
Cool. Yeah, keep right. everyone in suspense.
So here's our movie. John Carter, he's from Earth. He's from Civil yeah. War. Mm-hmm. He gets sent to Mars. I won't explain how because it actually ties into a whole bunch of
right.
plot things. But he goes to Mars where he finds himself caught in a battle for supremacy of the planet between
right.
two human clans.
Or human-looking.
Well, they bleed blue.
They bleed blue, but there's everything on the planet bleeds blue.
And so they're human. I mean, they seem human. But they don't have the special powers that he has.
Right.
Because they're from the planet.
Right.
And then you have the – what are they called? The Thrall?
There's the Tharks.
Tharks.
Which are the 15-foot primitives, let's say.
Which, as far as I can tell, those creatures were 100% CGI. Felt like it. I mean, I shouldn't say it felt like it. It felt like there was no other way they could have done that so perfectly.
Yeah, I think they had stand-ins while they were filming, but you know, then they just CGI'd over their stand-ins.
And there's this whole planetary war
right.
going on. And
it feels interplanetary because they did so much with just the different places on Mars.
Well,
you know,
and I was surprised how often they referred to and you know, flashback to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was surprised how much they used Earth considering – you know, all the Mars stuff that was going on.
Right, yeah.
And so he gets involved and, you know, against his will and, like, classic hero journey kind of thing going on. So the first thing I wanted to touch on, and this I did tell you already, because mm-hmm. I bought the soundtrack a couple days ago. And
right.
it's Michael Giacchino. I know I'm not saying his name right, but that's the way it seems like it should be said. Who did the music for the new Star Trek movie. He did the music for Lost. He did the music for a bunch of Pixar movies lately, Speed Racer. And he's one of – he's not my favorite composer, but if I was to say, like, my favorite composer now, it would be him, like, from the current time right now. If you're going to include, like, history of film, I wouldn't include him.
Okay, but you would include
he's,
John Williams.
Yeah,
in that
John
pile,
Williams, and Jerry Goldsmith, John
he's
Barry.
Your favorite, even on top of those.
Well, no, he's my favorite of the new guard, I guess. Like
okay.
I enjoy his soundtracks, and his soundtrack for John Carter, listening to it without any, you know, movie and without having seen any of the movie.
Right.
That soundtrack it harkens back to some of those old movies, you know, your James Horner and your John Williams, and
mm-hmm.
I also some of it sounded to me or reminded me of the Stargate SG-1 soundtrack from the TV series, even just kind of have that world sound to it,
right?
But then
which
that
is
adventure sound
for.
Too,
yeah.
it felt like it was pulled from an 80s action movie, an 80s sci-fi action movie, where they still had that big big orchestra feel and. I don't know. I liked listening to it alone, and then with the movie, it was nice too.
Cool.
So, what did you think of the music? Did it distract you, or did it pull you along?
You know what? It takes a very special soundtrack for me nowadays to really say that the music had any effect on me, and it's terrible because there's so much great music being put into the movies, but I think it's for me. That's what makes the movie good, is it doesn't take me out of the movie. And it did. What's his name? Giacchino, whatever his name is. It kept the movie going for me. It made the movie, you know, it touched all the little things
uh-huh.
that you're supposed to. So,
And there's one scene I want to talk with you about then
mm-hmm.
with the music.
Okay.
But I want to get to that scene later.
Okay.
So... All right. Well, what about you? What's first on your plate for discussing John Carter? John Carter, not John Carter of Mars.
Well, no, but still,
John Carter.
The name of the first book was not John Carter of Mars. Anyway,
it was Princess of Mars.
A Princess of Mars, but you can't name a movie a Princess of Mars and expect, you know, 10-year-old boys to flock to it.
Well, I don't know. The princess was pretty.
If it was 13-year-old boys, that would be one thing. But this is I actually took a 10-year-old and 11-year-old, and they said that their least favorite part was the kissing part, and I think that there was like one kissing part.
Yeah, so. I don't even remember. I mean, they kissed. Well, spoilers. We got to be careful.
Maybe there was, but
one part. Maybe they did, but
I think it was just one of those things where it wasn't a heavy element of the movie. You know, the love interest was sort of like gentle. It wasn't, you know, a Luke and Leia, then a Luke and Han thing, and you know, Luke and Han as her love interests, okay. And then all of a sudden it switched over to just Han. It was definitely not a Luke and Han thing.
Yeah, it would have been a different movie, but
yeah.
You know, I was surprised how much of it there was, though, and honestly, with that relationship, then I was willing to go with the relationship. You know, and go with that, just that. I mean, it's an action movie. And so in an action movie, you put a woman on the screen with the hero and they're going to fall in love, you know.
Yes.
But they actually worked on some of that with this. It gave it a little bit of a character push anyway.
Although this does lead into a mild criticism that I have.
All right.
About the movie. And as well acted as her part was, she's a princess.
Right.
She's a scientist.
Yes.
And she is a world-class combatant.
Yeah.
Skilled with the sword and all the jumping around and all that stuff. And I'm like, okay, that could be, but we don't see any build-up to that. We see her as a scientist, we see her as a princess, and then she's thrust into this situation where, for all intents and purposes, if you don't know anything about the genre, you don't know anything about what's expected of a character like this and in this situation, all of a sudden she turns on, you know, she flips a switch and she's a killing machine.
I don't know. I could kind of go with that simply because they're at war and everyone on the planet seems to be, you know, adept at fighting. It just seemed to be like...
But even that, if everyone is adept at fighting, then why would a princess scientist have anything except just defensive skills to get out of a situation and not thrust herself into the middle? I mean, she just injected herself into the middle of the entire thing.
Yeah, but if you're talking about that first scene, I don't want to give too many specifics, but, you know, she left. You know?
I don't know. It was just something where...
I was just wondering, is there anything this woman can't do?
Yeah, I know. I was expecting her to fly at some point. But that brings me to another point.
Well, she did. She could fly, too. Not fly like Superman, but...
But
she's a pilot.
Interesting that you brought up Superman is that in the original incarnation, well, not the very original, but as originally published by DC Comics, Superman had basically the skills and the powers that John Carter has.
Yeah, and this is kind of cool. I don't want to give away too much, and you know, because ultimately, I think so. If we are going to recommend this, then we're hoping that people will go see the movie. But this is a nice twist on that whole Superman idea, where instead of the Kryptonian coming to Earth and having special powers because of, you know, our sun and our gravity, you've got the Earthling going to Mars and having special powers, which you've probably seen in the commercials where he's just like,
jumping.
You know, jumping like over a city block, you know,
right.
He can leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Yes.
Oh, I like that.
I do. And, you know, when I have dreams of flying, it's like that. I don't have dreams of soaring. I have dreams of wild jumping and just like that. So that was a real fun callback to, you know, when I was a kid and I would have these dreams of me flying. But it was never actual flying. And I was like, how come I can't just fly? And I think because just my logic kicked in and said, you can't fly. And then the half logic in your dream says, well, okay, you can't fly, but you can do this. And and I would just always do that. You know, I would be jumping in these wild, long jumps that would never land. And it was just fantastic to see it on the screen. and almost to transplant myself into the character, even though it was, you know, I'm not a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah. But as he's testing himself out and figuring things out, you know, and learning the rules of the world, mm-hmm. That was fun. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
It did a good job, and they didn't make it too obvious that, you know, Superman was loosely based on him. It was just sort of like, hey, this is, and the director, Andrew Stanton, I think he was the director. Yeah. He did a really good job in trying to make this its own standalone piece, mm-hmm. you know, as if this had come out before, like, you know, this could have come out in 76. You know, albeit that you couldn't have done all the special effects and everything, but this could have been the influence, you know, the visual, the on screen influence for Star Wars and for, Alien or, you know, all the other different the stuff that came out afterwards, the Planet Bound, or even Spaceship Bound. You know, this is something that has that finiteness. It's bound on one thing. You know, it could have been the influence for those, and I think he did a good job bringing it back to that instead of saying, you know, well, I'm going to just build on top of all these other things that have been done.
Yeah, I did feel that this was, I mean, the way they built this movie, they were building it as if to say, you know, here's the foundation for a lot of your sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're gonna go ahead and take it, and we're not gonna worry about what's come before as far as movies go. Mm-hmm. We're just taking this old concept, and they kept the period too.
Yeah,
you know, the character is he's a Civil War vet.
Yeah,
and I was surprised that they didn't try and do something, you know, to make it more modern or whatever.
Yeah, because just a couple years ago they did a movie, A Princess of Mars. And they set it in more modern day, and I think it was an Afghanistan sniper or something, and he gets transported to a planet that the natives, I think, I'm getting this wrong, but I think the natives call it Barsoom, or they call it Mars or something. So there's like elements to the story.
Yeah, that came out at the same time as Avatar, didn't it?
I think
what's that company? Asylum or something like that. It's a company that makes mockbusters is what they call them.
Yeah.
And it's the fake version of the blockbuster. So there's Transmorphers.
Yeah.
And I watched part of that. Oh my goodness. You know, it's very, very low budget. But they also did a Sherlock Holmes movie that was Sherlock Holmes investigating, you know, some crimes and stuff, but it's like the steampunk thing with dinosaurs and it was just insane.
That
and so I did not
silly.
See the John Carter of Mars one that they did, or Princess of Mars that they did.
No, but I came across it while I was researching.
But the box said, I remember the box on it said, the story that inspired Avatar.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, they're trying to sell this as, you know, hey, if you liked Avatar. Yeah.
And there are some striking similarities. You know, there's a translation, let's say, of characters. I don't want to give too much away. There's an overly tall alien race that is more savage.
With four arms, by the way. That was something that bothered me about Avatar.
Yeah.
Avatar, every creature on the whole planet has six limbs.
Yeah.
The dragons had legs, wings, and arms. And every other, you know, those rhino creatures had six legs. And then you And then the intelligent species, four limbs. Every other creature on the whole planet has six, except for these ones. Come on.
Yeah, it was kind of silly.
But yeah, well, let's talk about these creatures, though, from John Carter. What'd you think? I was impressed.
I liked it. Aliens, if you guys haven't seen the movie or anything about it, they have tusks sort of that go up instead of...
Well, the males go up.
Yeah,
they come like on their jawline.
Yeah,
and go out and go up, and then the females come from their jawline but go down.
Yeah, and it's individual. Like each one has their own. And if you really look, I mean, they do have face paint and things like that, so you can tell them apart. But if you're looking at the tusks, you can tell them apart as well.
They use them.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
when the two alpha males were kind of, you know.
Yep, they locked
button heads. They locked tusks.
Yeah,
that was cool.
That was, yeah, it was a way where, you know, in the books, I don't think they covered that. You know, I think they just said these things had tusks and sort of, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs wanted to make it seem like these things were frightening, just visually frightening.
Yeah.
So he gave them tusks. And now we have the movie adding a little bit to that. And all of a sudden, you see the tusks as what animals would use them for, you know, for aggression.
But let's talk about these humans, too, because this is another thing that has to do with the effects, is they have these awesome flying machines.
They did, yeah.
I loved these flying machines. I love the look of the technology. They don't explain the technology.
They don't. And I don't. One thing I don't like about the technology is that some things that seem really frail can seemingly take a ton of beating. And then there are some things that you would think, oh, these have some, you know, shields or at least some sort of protection. And those things, you know, it's like one shot and they're done. So I didn't particularly think that it was well thought out the way that air battles were taking place.
Well, I wonder, though.
But they were beautiful.
I'd like to see some of the concept design to see just actually what were they thinking when they were doing this? Because there was a logic to it. You could feel it felt right, but they never explained how this technology how these things fly works. And I'm okay with them not explaining to it as long as it feels good.
But the thing is, if this movie were made, you know, in the early part of last century, you know, if he wrote the books and they said, hey, let's make some movies, you know, the black and white, non-talking movies, silent movies, or even, you know, in the 30s or something, when I think they actually were starting to come up with a cartoon version of it. But they didn't. I think they would have to sort of touch on it because the technology would have been so new to people that people would say like, oh, wow, well, you know, obviously the Wright brothers came up with this and, you know, that would be so fresh. That they would say, how would that happen on this planet? Who are the Wright brothers on this planet? And you mentioned the Wright brothers nowadays to most teenagers, and they'll be like, the Wright who?
I don't know, though, because if you look at Metropolis, you know, I don't know if they really explained like how things worked in Metropolis. It was magical. Metropolis, well, the movie from, 1910
But that was set in the future. This is set in the past.
What? So, well, it's set in the past, but it's set on another planet.
It is, but it's
like
still...
the technology comes from this other planet. And so I think the way it's written here, as I think the way it would play out if they had made it then, was it just works. Go with us.
I guess.
And maybe not have even the logic that this felt like it had.
I think
so. Or the thought, anyway.
You're probably right. And I think when you put in the... you know, is it too much of a spoiler to say who the really big, the actual threat? I don't know if it's too much of a spoiler. But once you find out who the actual threat is and you find out a little bit about them,
those guys.
Yeah, you seem to think to yourself, you know, well, is there anything that's beyond their scope because of the different things that they introduce?
Well, and the main villains, you know, the ones who are kind of pulling the strings and stuff, those guys, I feel like there was a good set of laws for them as far as what they can and can't do, although part of their character being they maybe don't even know what they can't do, you know, and there's just some good character stuff going on, too.
There were, and I did like the idea of the characters, although I didn't feel like I felt like we were told by them what they were all about instead of, you know, discovering it or being shown. You know, it wasn't proved.
Right.
So you still get this idea that, you know, maybe they're wildly powerful, but how powerful?
And the other thing is they tell a whole lot of stuff. You know, there is a lot of, for them, there's a lot of show, I mean, a lot of telling rather than showing.
Yeah.
I'm watching this and I'm thinking, I don't believe that. You know, I'm wondering, you know, are they telling the truth? Because, well, they're bad. You know,
Right.
And I guess they have no reason to lie because, you know, they don't answer to anyone or whatever. But I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if this is really
Yeah.
You know, the things they're saying don't seem like it's true, because why would you know, do the classic bad guy, you know? Well, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing, and we can tell you now because you're gonna
Yeah.
die, you know.
Right. Monologuing. But I
Yeah.
think
It's plot exposition. It has to go somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think one of the things is I think they have no reason to tell the truth either. I
Yeah,
think
yeah.
they're so deep in whatever they're doing that, they have no qualms saying whatever comes to mind, whatever fills that space at this moment that furthers their machinations. That's what they're going to say.
Well, I like
So,
them being in this story. And so
yeah.
you have these kind of three or four parties. You know, you have the Mars humans who are divided in two, and you have
The
the
Tharks,
Tharks, you
and
know,
then
and although there's this whole this kind of barbaric Tharks in the middle there, who I'm wondering, is that the setup for the sequel? Is you've got this other group of Tharks who are, you know, kind of just
could be.
they pop up and then they go away. And then you have this other, you know, these other bad guys, and between the four of them, there's a lot of plot twists and a
Right.
lot of just things happening that I, you know, part of it I'm expecting, part of it I'm not, and then I'm realizing, oh, okay, that's where this was going. That makes sense. That makes sense. I like that. And I mean, we won't talk about the ending at all, but I love the twisty plotty stuff going on at the end of the movie.
Well, I like the one thing that was good. If you read the novels, some of them are set up in it's as if they were real. They really happened, and Edgar Rice Burroughs found the manuscripts or was given them or whatever, and then transcribed them and put them out there for the public to read and to enjoy. But of course, they're written. In very much that period, Dracula was written as if it was letters and things like that. But just that same way, and this is set up very similarly, and not in a way that a lot of films do this nowadays. Like there's an Edgar Allan Poe film coming out that, Edgar Allan Poe, all his someone is a mass murderer and they're killing people and basing them on Edgar Allan Poe's stuff. So he has to sort of be a literary character in this movie, and it sort of breaks that separation that I like to have, But this. It is actually following how the books started, and the very first thing you read in the book is about how, he was called to his to John Carter's place, and he wasn't able to get there in time, and John Carter was put in this grave, this mausoleum or whatever. They can only open from the inside, and you're like, whoa, only opens from the inside.
Yeah, it
How
starts
wacky is
out with a
that?
nice,
Yeah.
interesting mystery.
Yeah.
And I was, did you know they were going to use Edgar Allan Poe before, or not Edgar Rice Burroughs before
I did not
going to
know.
see it? Were you
Nope.
surprised about that? Because
So
it feels old school
yeah.
as far as the storytelling goes, and I liked it.
What I thought they were going to do is jump is have the roll the credits in the beginning and do some thematic stuff where you don't really know what you're looking at, and then all of a sudden you realize it's Mars. Someone wakes up and he's looking around and he's on Mars, and then backtrack from there, and he's remembering the different things and all that stuff. And I thought they were going to fill in the past that way. I didn't think they were going to have such a huge setup at the beginning of him actually on Earth. But that was all to set up
Well,
the.
yeah, and you have Edgar Rice Burroughs, and he's reading the journal, and that's the story. That's our movie,
Yep.
is the journal of John Carter.
Right.
I like that. I like that setup. All right, well, what else do you got?
What else? Let me look at my notes. I did mention that about Dejah Thoris, who is the princess, and her fighting prowess. And this is something that happens in movies, and it's just shorthand for we don't know what else to do. And I don't like it.
And what is it?
And it happens too much. There's another character, one of the tall aliens,
uh-huh.
And she's a young one of the tall aliens, and they're not overly strong. They're not, you know, anything spectacular, except they have four arms. And of course, Deja Thoris is a warrior princess. And at one point, to get away, John Carter basically just tosses Deja over to Sola for her to hold while they ride an animal off into the distance, and John Carter has to go and do something. And I'm like, really? She's a warrior princess. If she really wants to be somewhere else, she's not going to have Sola stand in her way. You know, Sola is basically a little girl. And I didn't like that. There were certain things where it did that shorthand where I don't like it. Another one was, this was horrible. If you know anything about, you know, physics and spatial physics, at one point, John Carter jumps, and then Deja Thoris falls from something, and they meet in air. So John Carter is able to, and he can't change anything while he's in air. If he's in the air, he's like the Hulk. If something hits him, he falls to the ground. But he's able to time his jump perfectly to anticipate her falling at the exact everything to meet her where she is, so he saves her. And I'm like, that's just it's sloppy. It looked
really cool.
But it was the type of thing where, you know what, something can look cool and real sloppy at the same time.
Well, let's go back to the princess character. Because, I mean, technically, she's the title character.
Yes.
You know, and I guess from the book, she doesn't wear anything.
At some points, yeah.
But in the movie, you know, she's got her skimpy warrior garb and then her skimpy, you know, dressy dress. Thing.
Yeah, picture Leela from Doctor Who or something like that, you know.
But I'm thinking to myself about this character. It kind of goes to those two extremes of she's so competent because she's a female. So since she's the female lead, she can do everything. There's nothing she can't do. But then on the other hand, because we're watching a movie called John Carter, you know, that we're obviously focusing on the dude.
Right.
You know, who's going to, you know, save the day, rescue her, you know, and those kind of things. And in some cases, maybe rescue her, even though she doesn't need it because mm-hmm. she's so competent.
Right.
That was one thing that I just kind of noticed was they tried to kind of walk the line between she's so amazing that she doesn't need anyone's help, but she also needs to be the damsel in distress. And this happens a lot. And I think that I look at like Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
and with Princess Leia, I feel like they really found the right balance of competent, but then they still had to rescue her, you know.
But the thing with Deja Thoris is that she is politically a pawn, so she has no power politically.
But she's trying to, though. I mean, one thing I did appreciate about that was with the whole science stuff she was doing. When she was doing her sciencey things,
right? Yeah.
She was trying to be proactive, which I like in my characters. I like my characters to be proactive.
Yeah, but politically, she was just a pawn. But in every other way, she was extremely competent or over competent. So I think it was an interesting balance that way, saying, you know, here's someone who is so competent in so many different things, and in this one thing she has no power, you know, and sort of like you're looking at someone who it's, you know, Superman with a kryptonite necklace, you know. I mean,
I just wish she hadn't been so flawless. I didn't see any kind of room for any kind of growth in that character.
Well, yeah, but she's not a growth character, really.
No, she's not. She's not. But every other character was.
Right.
Even the bad guys had some, you know, there's a little bit of growth in the in our the main antagonists, you know, they had some growth to do, not a lot, but some.
Yeah.
The leader of the opposite forces of the humans, he, you know, he had a little bit of change that he resisted. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, which is what usually happens.
Yeah.
And I can't get that alien race.
The Tharks. Or Therns.
Yeah.
There's two different ones.
Yeah,
the Tharks are the tall ones.
With the Tharks, you've got, you know, there's a lot of character growth there.
Well, yeah.
And so everyone had room to grow except for her. And I would have liked to have seen maybe her problem being like what you just said, as far as she's really competent in every area except for this one.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's she overcomes that, or maybe it's that she accepts that she's powerless there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, or in looking at her weakness, finds her strength. You know, I don't know. She was a plot device in some places, and she was eye candy plot device is what I sometimes felt like they were trying to overcompensate for the fact they knew she's here to look pretty and she's here to be, you know, part of what moves our plot because she's the princess.
But I think saying all that, I think she did a very good job.
Yes. She rose above what she was given, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The actress playing her, I think.
Yeah. Although she had a British accent. So immediately I assumed that she was, you know, from the Empire or, you know,
she's the bad evil guy. Yeah.
She was the villain.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk quickly about some of the effects stuff going on.
Okay.
Because I was really quite pleasantly surprised with how good these effects looked. There was some parts, though, where it just... I can't imagine watching this on a small television. Because
because
the
it's
scene
intricate.
Was so big, and there's so much stuff in the scene. And so your characters are just these little tiny things moving around on the screen. Even on a theater screen, they
right.
were small.
Yeah.
And so but there was... I'm watching these ships, these flying ships. At the very beginning of the movie, I'm thinking to myself, those look like models. They look like they're actually real. And maybe even like model work or whatever. But
right.
then you can see there's little tiny people, you know, yeah. running around on them and controlling them.
Yeah.
And there's so much of the ship is open to the air. And so
right.
you see the insides. It's not just a spaceship where you can't see anything except for maybe a shadow walking past a window. But it's... You can see them. They're running around. They're moving parts.
Yeah.
They're controlling the ships. I was impressed. I really liked that.
And it had a very steampunk feel to it. It didn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't over the top.
Yeah.
But I think they really said, you know, hey, let's do a little steampunk here and make it feel as if it were. If it was 100 years, you know, ago that they were making the movie, or at least the designs for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of wood, a lot of textures, a lot of, you know, very interesting ways that they put things together.
Well, and ornately detailed, like railings
yeah.
and walkways. And
yeah,
I was very impressed with all the technology as far as the world technology.
Right, right.
And the creature effects, again, I just...
they did a great job.
What was the name of the dog thing?
Woola.
That thing, you know?
That was awesome.
He could have been super annoying.
Oh, it could have been Jar Jar, but it turned out to be Chewie.
It could have been a Jar Jar, but yeah. Well, or Lassie, you know?
Super Lassie, yeah.
And it could have been really annoying, but they dialed it back and treated it like a pet would be in the real world rather than a pet in a movie for kids, which this movie was not for kids.
I think it was for 10-year-old boys. You know, I think it really had that appeal to it.
Yeah.
You know, I have an 8-year-old girl. I would not have brought her to this. You know, just too much blood and guts, that type of thing. The 10-year-old boys, you know, it didn't have any nudity. It had a couple of instances of taking the Lord's name in vain, which, you know, is regrettable because you don't really need it.
It's PG-13.
It is PG-13, but for PG-13, you know, there was a lot of blood, a lot of combat, which is what I expected.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't think that they were going to go I thought they would go more, you know, with, you know, a more risque type of stuff with the princess instead of, you know, just throwing in a couple of, you know, words that really didn't need to be in the script. I mean, it was just...
But let me ask you this then. Your boys, did they like it?
They loved it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching it and I'm liking it and I'm enjoying what I'm seeing. But I'm thinking to myself, is this the movie that if I'd seen this when I was 10, 11, 12, would I have really enjoyed and been engaged by it? Because it seems slow in some parts. And, you know, okay, the music thing I was going to ask you about. There's a battle scene in the middle of the movie. Mm-hmm. That was really the only what I thought was that muscular pulp Robert E. Howard, Edgar Rice Burroughs, those, you know, those, that Conan Tarzan type feel. And mm-hmm. I haven't read any John Carter books. I've read Conan and I've read Tarzan and so I and some other, you know, pulp things from
right.
the turn of the century.
Right.
That scene is him, you know, and he's fighting the Martian creatures, the Tharks. He's fighting the Tharks, and he's just going to town, and
yeah.
they're coming, and they keep coming and coming and coming, and yeah. I'm reminded of Conan, you know, and,
yeah, that type of thing, or Samson,
but
yeah,
the music there is like this very slow and melodic and mournful music.
Yeah.
And it's not the heroic march.
Yeah, well, because he's doing this because, I mean, he has to.
And
it's
and
not
it's a
anything.
Sacrifice.
It's
not,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not, he's not doing it in rage.
Yeah.
Although, you know, he's working himself up, you know, as far as just
yeah, you wouldn't
to do a battle, but I mean, he's and it's not like he's doing it to rescue someone at the end of the line or whatever, but there's and then there's a juxtaposition there of the music, and there's a juxtaposition that I won't tell right now, but there's a juxtaposition of you know, something else that you're bouncing around as you're in that scene. And it kind of took the movie in a different direction because it could have just been roar, blood,
right.
guts, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And instead it was, you know, just this, it reminded me of Michael Giacchino's, when he did he scored the beginning of the Star Trek movie,
mm-hmm.
where,
yeah.
You know, the ship comes through and it attacks and Jim, you know, Captain Kirk's father and mother are on the ship
right.
and she's
yeah.
giving birth to Captain Kirk. He's not captain, obviously, because he's, you know,
he was
baby.
Born a captain.
Yeah. Well, almost in that movie. But, you know, and his father is doing the heroic, you know, sacrifice, you know, I'm going to sacrifice myself to save my son and my wife. And that music is just, you know, takes it to another level where
yeah.
I, as a father, and as a father especially who had a young daughter at that time,
mm-hmm.
who I got choked up every time.
Yeah.
All three times that I saw that movie in the theater, I got choked up. And I didn't get choked up with John Carter here, but that music kind of took me back to that feel of just
yeah.
this slow and melodic and juxtaposed against, like, he is going to town.
Yeah.
And they are coming, and he is killing, and they keep coming, and he keeps killing. And they take it, like, I don't want to give away the end of this scene, but it, like, goes to that just logical extreme where
yeah.
you're just like, oh my goodness. Yeah, that's what would happen.
Yeah. Even with that scene, you know, I mean, the boys that I took were, or that it was, that were with me were church kids, and they had seen comic books with Samson or,
mm-hmm.
you know, David and Goliath or whatever. And they'd seen stuff just like that. So I had I didn't have a problem.
But were
with
they
them.
Enjoying it? I mean, did that scene engage them?
They didn't mention it one way or the other, but you know, it was. I think it was for them. It was another scene in the movie. And I mean, I don't know how much of when you're a 10-year-old, how many you know plot points and things like that you really pick up, but you know at that point in their lives, I think it's just you know as long as nothing is completely jarring and you know the Pac-Man comes onto the screen or something like that, it's not going to make that much of a huge impact on them. It just adds to the whole of the story, well, and I think that did.
And to me, it added to the impact, and
I
liked that. I liked what they were doing with that scene.
Right.
And there's lots and lots of big triumphant battling to happen later too, and oh, earlier. I mean, it's just there's a lot of battling in this movie.
Yes, hold on.
And
PG-13.
I enjoyed it. You know, as I'm watching it, I'm enjoying the ride.
So, would you recommend it?
I would. I'd recommend it as, you know, a big action movie with a little bit of romance and a little bit of, there's some themes that I was digging, you know,
what deeper themes did you see in there?
I didn't see a lot. Don't get me wrong, but there is the theme of change, of characters changing. And of course the change comes from the power of love, you know, the power of love conquers all and, yeah, but you know you have this bitter, hardened person who can't let go of the past,
right?
And who just doesn't believe in anything, and doesn't believe that anything is worth fighting for in this world,
right?
And then he's thrown into a world where he has to fight, you know, or
yeah.
I mean, it's even more extreme than what he found on Earth, where you know he can turn his back, but. Does he want to turn his back? And
right.
You know, there's love involved now and everything like that. So there's that. There's also the there was a theme of sacrifice going throughout there as well. You know, personal sacrifice, and that kind of goes with the change with the character.
Right.
As
a creator, as a writer yourself.
Wait. I got one more theme.
Okay, go ahead.
That I picked up on that I don't know if they were planning this or meaning this, and it didn't go along with the overarching theme of the whole movie, but they had a couple things where they were mentioning, they're talking, John Carter's talking to the princess that he's from Earth, and she doesn't believe him. Mm-hmm. And she says, "You're mad." And he says, "Or I'm a liar." And then of course there's that third logical choice that can be made. He's either a madman, a liar, or he's telling the truth.
That's right.
You know, and that goes back to, I don't know, C.S. Lewis invented those arguments,
popularized,
but you know,
at least,
yeah, Jesus is either a madman, a liar, or telling the truth when he was on Earth saying he was God,
right?
And you know, I don't know if they were intentionally, you know, using that because of C.S. Lewis, or if they're just, it's clever and it fits in the script,
yeah.
But I thought of it immediately as they were thinking, you know, saying that. Oh, that's kind of fun. I like that you went there. I don't know if you went there on purpose, but I like that you went there.
And one interesting touch that it's sort of along, it was around that time, they are trying to figure out exactly where he's from. And they lay out rocks in orbits around another rock. And interestingly, they, did you catch it?
Nine.
Well, there was nine rocks, but one represents the sun. So there's eight rocks.
Oh, they didn't include Pluto.
They didn't include Pluto because at the time it hadn't been discovered.
And now it doesn't matter.
But the interesting thing is, what is Pluto to these people? I mean, in the actual book, they have a device where they can see other planets. You know, and when John Carter is introduced to Dejah Thoris, she knows intimate details about Earth because she has seen it, you know, with their devices. And she says, you know, they can see on any other planet or a star and see what's happening on those things.
Hmm.
And that was completely lost in the movie. I mean, it would just recast the movie, I think, as something that...
Yeah, you know, I'm glad they didn't have that.
It wouldn't have fit in. But it was interesting that they did that with the planets. And I don't know if it was because someone was dopey enough to think that there's all, you know, that Pluto never was a planet, so you know, they wouldn't include it because they're snobby, or if they said, you know, well, Pluto hadn't been discovered yet, and so we're not going to put it in there. So, you know, it's one or the other, but it was interesting nonetheless.
Yeah.
Now, as a writer,
yeah,
when you write a book, do you concentrate heavily on the protagonist being a like a change character or a steadfast character, that type of feel? Does that really come into it, or does it just
change doesn't have to be there, but there has to be the potential for change,
right?
And it comes down to character choice. Then I think a character, a good protagonist and a good antagonist, there needs to be the potential for change. And the potential for change comes from your character's choice.
Right.
Absolutely. And how they respond to things.
Now, when they take a source material and the protagonist is a certain way, like, for instance, in the source material, John Carter is a steadfast character. At the end, he's the same as in the beginning because he has made that choice not to change for the worse. In the movie, they recast it a little bit, and I won't, you know, ruin any plot points or anything, but they make it so that he is a character that changes from the beginning to the end. So he has made a choice to be better than he was at the beginning, which is, you know, the nature of that type of thing. Does that bother you as someone watching something from
It depends. If they changed my source material,
right,
then I would have a problem with that.
Okay.
Because obviously I'm not going to do anything wrong. Why are they changing what I've done?
That's right. You've written perfect.
Exactly. But no, I do think it's more satisfying to have a character go through trials that when they come out on the other end, they have changed for the better.
Really?
That's more satisfying to me as a reader.
Really? Okay.
It's not always the best choice for the story. It's not always the best choice for the character. And not having read the source material here, I like what they did with it. I like what they did with him, that he comes through and he's a better person on the other side.
Okay.
It's simplistic. You know, it's an action-adventure movie.
Right, yeah.
But it's an action-adventure movie that took the time to develop character and have some character change and movement and momentum.
Right. But at the same time, I really enjoy sometimes when you get a movie with a really strong character at the beginning, given these, you know, choices, really hard choices, and does not take them because of the, you know, inevitable outcome of
that's a different kind of story, though.
It is.
Different kind of story. And that's sometimes a more honest story,
right,
but it's not necessarily a more satisfying story.
I don't know. Perhaps we just, you know, like slightly different things. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that we like that's the same, so I don't think this is a major dividing point. But
no, again, you have to be true to the characters, though. And when you're doing an adaptation, you are not doing the same character as the original source material, especially if you change plot at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you change the plot, you know, it kind of goes back to our time travel discussion.
Yeah.
You know, where when you change the events that happen around you, that changes how you react to the events. And so you change a character's story, you're going to change the character.
Right.
And I don't know how close they follow any of the original plot for this movie and the original book, but
yeah, they took elements of the plot.
They
the first three books, yeah.
It did not feel like they were. It felt like, to me, the screenwriter came in, had a skeleton of an idea from the originals, and then they said, "Let's make a better, not a better story, but a story that's going to fit a 2-hour and 15-minute movie that we're trying to, you know, when people walk out of the theater, we want them to walk out with a smile on their face. We want them to walk out feeling like they've seen something that they enjoy. Because when you walk out, you know, if you end on a somber note, like say you have a character who he needs to do the right thing, and so he goes through all this and finally he gets to the end and he doesn't do the right thing.
Yep.
He's gone through all this, but he still chooses not to do the right thing.
Right.
It's got to be really good for that to be pulled off,
right,
and to feel like you've been through a satisfying character arc.
Yeah.
So
now, do you feel in the not giving away any of the details of the end, but do you feel that the end was satisfying to you as a viewer?
Yes, and I was worried that it wouldn't be. I was worried after I saw some, you know, we're getting close to the end. I'm thinking, oh wait, they're going here with this? Oh. But then I realized, no, and I kind of was able to kind of piece together some of the twists there at the end.
Right.
And the guy I was with at the movie, he said, why didn't he just do that? And I said, because this is why. And then I was right. But they twisted it, though. I thought they're going this way with it. And then they twisted it, and I thought, oh, I'm wrong. They went this other direction. And then they went back, and I turned out to be right. You know,
cool.
Oh, that's cool. I like the ending. I like that Edgar Rice Burroughs actually played a part in the story. You know, he's there at the beginning and he's there at the end, but he's not just there to open the journal, you know,
right,
and read the story for us.
Right.
He's there because he's a part of John Carter's life.
Right.
You know, and I like that. But overall, I do recommend it. I'm probably not going to take my son to see it in the theater because that's a lot of money.
It is. It is, yeah. And the 3D, I don't think, makes it so outside the box special that you would have to see it in the theater. You know, I mean, with us, we have the theater, and it's very close, and it's one of the biggest screens in the world.
Yeah. Keep bragging.
So, I mean, I feel like every time that a movie comes out that I want to see, I have to see it in 3D on one of the biggest screens in the world. I just have to. And
but do you recommend this movie? Let's forget the theater. Do you recommend the movie?
With a couple of caveats with the language, you know, if you're sensitive to language, if you're going to bring kids that aren't used to that language, you know, you just might want to warn them that some people say some things that aren't so nice.
Anyone who goes to a public school.
Yeah, anyone that goes to
they're hearing
school.
Much, much worse, much, much more often. There is not much going on with the language.
Yeah, pretty much. If you're a 10-year-old boy or if you have those sensibilities, I would recommend it highly, yeah.
You think there's enough romance for my wife, who's not a geek?
Right. No. No, yeah. Although the character is Deja Thoris is a very strong character. And, you know, to tell the truth, the Thark girl, Sola, is as much as she's in the film, she has a good part to play. So, you know, so there's something there. If you take a younger girl, like 11 or 12 year old girl, you know, as long as she can understand that that's an 11 or 12 year old alien with tusks, that's a little girl, you know.
Was she meant to be a little girl?
She's supposed to be a young female.
She's not much smaller than the other characters that are around her.
She's not, but she is. She is. She's put up to be the daughter of Tars Tarkas, which is one of the leaders of the Tharks. So, you know, just whenever you have someone who is a daughter of someone, and you don't have the you don't know the ages of these things. You know, they're supposed to be living for hundreds of years. So,
okay.
You know, they could.
Okay.
So she's supposed to be a younger version of them. Yes.
Well, we call this a mini-sode, Steve. We've gone for an hour.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, we have.
Yeah. And there were some things we didn't even talk about that I wanted to talk about. But,
what's a maxi mini-sode, I guess?
I guess so.
What did you want to talk about? Anything real quick that we can hit?
No, nothing real quick. And nothing that, I mean, we've covered a lot of the stuff, you know. We covered the creatures and the battles and some of the meat. And I will say this, you know, some movies there's enough meat in them that you're like, yeah, go see this movie because there's some great ideas in this movie. This one doesn't have like a lot of awesome killer, you know, this is gonna make you think moments.
But there's
some satisfying stuff
there. If you dig, there are. What do you think, real quick? What did you think about the discussions and the things they broached with religion, with the Martian religion?
It was interesting.
Do you have any major thoughts on it? Or?
Not really, because they didn't really touch on a lot.
No,
but they, you know, the whole idea was, is it real or not?
Right.
You know, and
I think a future one of the, I think they're going to probably do, you know, one or two more movies based on it, and if they do, I think one of them is just going to be dealing with that. One of the, I think the second novel is called The Gods of Mars. So, you know, if they continue on with the meat that they've pulled out of the first three books, and different things that I saw in this movie, I think they may go that way and discuss that type of thing. And it goes much more in depth. I don't want to give anything away. I did a little research before I.
I'll tell you though, you can see where, you know, assuming that this is fairly true to the spirit of the original books, mm-hmm. you can see where C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet is kind of a response to some of these Mars stories.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because they, you know, they get to Mars, and you know, Mars is meant to be a war. You know, Mars is the god of war, and so
right.
the Martians in H.G. Wells come to take over the Earth. You know, right. John Carter goes to Mars, where there's these, you know, warring tribes and
right.
you know, big battles and stuff. And Ransom in Out of the Silent Planet goes to Mars, and the humans are expecting all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it turns out they're peace loving.
Yeah,
you know, and
they're unfallen.
They're unfallen, and so here you have these humans bringing their guns and everything to Mars.
Well, so, a maxi minisode. What are you going to call it?
Well, I think we're going to stick with just not calling it a minisode.
Okay. Well,
because this is definitely not a minisode.
No. Nope.
So, if you stuck around with us for the last hour and you thought, "Oh, I'm getting a 20-minute episode," well, no, no, you're not. This was our hour-long review of...
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, Siskel and Ebert, they talked about a movie in 5 minutes. Why couldn't
yeah.
we? But it's an and interesting was, movie. I enjoyed it. And
this
I
wasn't
think
Shakespeare
that,
or anything either. So
no, kinda, definitely not.
But, you know, I think it's a sort of a testament to the movie itself that we could talk about it for an hour and still be, you know, not lacking in topics to we could go for another, you know, half an hour or so.
I don't think I could go another half hour.
Well,
I don't.
I'm just saying. I just threw the number out. Just
other
to,
than to say, you know, the only other topic we didn't talk about is how some things just happen so quick.
That yeah.
You're like, oh, they're getting ready for this big, huge bat. Oh, it's done.
Yes.
And then you're like, okay, this is going to be, oh, that's a huge, long battle. What's going on here?
Yeah.
So they keep you on your toes.
Oh yeah,
on your toes.
And it's interesting because a lot of movies wouldn't do that. They would say, "Oh no, we have to take the time and spell this thing out in broad, large letters filled with
yeah.
blood."
Yeah.
And here it's more of like an exclamation point.
There was some blood and gore, but it was all blue.
Yeah,
I mostly. Think that's how they. If it had been red blood, they would have been R, immediate R. But because
yeah.
it was blue, I think they were able to get away with it.
So. Yeah.
For Dr. Jace, I'm...
Congratulations.
I'm Ben, and with me has been Steve, and we're going to sign off. So,
finally.
Yeah.
All right, guys, thank you for listening, obviously, if you listened this far. And
hey, let us know what you thought of the movie if you saw it, and we
definitely.
Will include your comments in our next real episode that is a real episode not intended to be a mini episode.
There you go.
All right.
All right, everybody. God bless you all.
Godspeed. You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Dr. Jace O'Neill, and Steve McDonald. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. We invite you to join the conversation by visiting our website, www.strangersandaliens.com, where you'll find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at Strange and Alien, or like us on our Facebook page. If you'd like to email us directly, our email is podcast@strangersandaliens.com. And once again, thanks for listening. Siskel and Ebert, they talked about a movie in 5 minutes. Why couldn't we?